From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, literary landscapes in medieval and Victorian England. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are Anthony Kenny of Oxford University and Robert Yeager of the University of North Carolina at Asheville. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Anthony Kenny about Arthur Hugh Clough, the English poet who lived from 1819 till 1861. Following that, a discussion with Robert Yeager about English literature and its audiences in the late Middle Ages. On the Victorian poet Arthur Hugh Clough, here is Anthony Kenny.
I think that he's one of the most neglected Victorian poets. I would rate him as one of the four best Victorian poets, along with Browning, Tennyson, Hopkins. But I have a number of particular interests in him. First of all, he came from my hometown, Liverpool. He was a student at the College Balliol, where I'm now master. And he had a rather similar history to my own. Namely, he began as being somebody very religious, moved through a crisis of faith, and became an agnostic, though always throughout his life taking religion very seriously and clinging on to vestiges of faith. It's one of the reasons why I think that Clough is deserves much more recognition as a Victorian poet, is that though he's very much a poet of his time, creature of his age, yet he strikes very often a contemporary note. A lot of our stereotypes of what the Victorians were like will not survive a reading of Clough.
Was it necessarily a loss of faith that we are talking about when you describe what the Victorians lived through?
I think that what most troubled Clough was not the advancement of science, but initially literary criticism. He was very much affected by the study of the scholars in the Tübingen school in Germany. Mm-hmm. Who began to persuade the learned world that maybe the four Gospels oughtn't to be taken as gospel, that
now,
they were...
Is this what we call the higher criticism?
Yes, that's right. The very beginning of it, people like F.C. Bauer and Strauss. Mm-hmm. Strauss's Life of Jesus that was translated by George Eliot. That whole school of thought influenced him. He wrote one poem called Epistrausium, which begins Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, evanished, all and gone, that he was worried that you, in the light of higher criticism, you couldn't take the Gospels as literally true anymore.
Tell me, Anthony Kenny, about some of the relationships that Clough might have had with other noteworthy, religious figures in Victorian England.
He was a colleague of John Henry Newman. They were both fellows of Oriel College. Mm-hmm. During the years that Clough was a tutor in Oxford. I think that he came to feel with others of the time that Newman was showing people that there was no real choice other than that of Catholicism or agnosticism, that the kind of halfway house, the Via Media, that was presented by the Roman Church, by the Church of England,
right,
was not really a viable halfway house, and some people reacted to this by following Newman into Rome. Others reacted to it as Clough himself did, by going out of the Church of England in the other direction.
Is it fair to say, to reduce it to a phrase, the life of Clough, the problem of his religious faith, to talk in terms of all or nothing? Was that his difficulty? Was that the peril that he succumbed to in grappling with religious questions?
He was impatient with compromises and half-truths, I think, very much, and regarded a lot of what other people did as being their compromising with truth and involving hypocrisy to one degree or another.
Anthony Kenny, let me ask you to key these observations that you've been making about Clough to some of the poetry. Let's make reference to the things that he wrote.
Yes, I'd like to do that. There's one poem called Easter Day, which he wrote in Naples at the end of the continental tour that we were talking about earlier. And that expresses his coming to terms with his own disbelief in the resurrection of Jesus. It begins, "Through the great sinful streets of Naples as I passed, with fiercer heat than flamed above my head, my heart was hot within me, till at last my brain was lightened when my tongue had said, Christ is not risen. Christ is not risen. No, he lies and moulders low. Christ is not risen. Is he not risen? And shall we not rise? O we unwise! What did we dream? What wake we to discover? Ye hills fall on us, and ye mountains cover, in darkness and great gloom. Come ere we thought, it is our day of doom. From the cursed world which is our tomb, Christ is not risen."
Help me to understand those lines. Is Clough writing about what, the commonplace as the point of our religious experience, that we shouldn't expect miracles and bells and whistles, that we have to look, what, we have to be more mundane in our understanding, our approach to questions of faith and religion?
Well, he thinks that the literal truth of the resurrection isn't any longer tenable. But what is, many people, of course, have thought that. What I think is special about his poem is that he faces up to the fact that if Christ did not rise from the dead, then in all kinds of ways, the world is much duller than the believer thinks it does. He says, "Eat, drink, and die, for we are men deceived. Of all the creatures under heaven's wide cope, we are most hopeless who had once most hope. We are most wretched that had most believed. Christ is not risen." And then he goes on, "Eat, drink, and play, and think that this is bliss. There is no heaven but this. There is no hell, save earth, which serves the purpose doubly well, seeing it visits still with equalest apportionments of ill, both good and bad alike, and brings to one same dust the unjust and the just with Christ who is not risen."
This is a terribly pessimistic, grim picture that you are painting for me of the life and the poetry of Arthur Clough.
I think it is, in a way, grim. That is that he, unlike many people who can just kind of shake off religion and laugh, Clough was always immensely aware of the importance in men's lives of religion, but he thought that it was more important to follow truth than to deceive oneself with illusion, which he believed many of his fellow men were doing.
Is that the silver lining here in the life and the work of Arthur Clough?
Yes, I think that he did find personal satisfaction in the humble but real tasks to which he devoted himself, rather than the illusory dogmatizing which he would have regarded as a possible alternative. And also because in the course of worrying over his own faith, like the grain of sand in an oyster, there comes out this marvelous pearl of his poetry. If you think of him as a poet, he is enormously successful. Judged by worldly standards, I think he was very unsuccessful.
Are you telling me, Anthony Kenny, that we should take some small comfort in the aesthetic achievement of this man, even though beyond what, the formal, the measurable, the aesthetic, there is this, I remember a phrase from a literary critic, the Victorian wasteland. Mm-hmm. Even though we have to face that, really, am I supposed to take some comfort just in the fact that this man wrote beautiful poetry?
Yes, indeed. I think that there was comfort in his own life because of his eventual satisfaction in marriage and the work that he was doing for the world. And I think he left behind substantial achievement. But I've quoted deliberately a rather somber bit of his poetry. Let me conclude, perhaps, by reading a slightly more light-hearted thing which he wrote on the same theme.
What's this called?
It's part of his final unfinished masterpiece Dipsychus, which is a dialogue between the soul and itself, or one half of the soul and the other half of the soul. And it's something which he puts in the mouth of the Mephistophelian part of the soul, the kind of...
The diabolical
part. But it shows how he also likes to analyze the different motives that people have for their beliefs. There is no God, the wicked saith, and truly it's a blessing. For what he might have done with us, it's better only guessing. There is no God, a youngster thinks, or really, if there may be, he surely didn't mean a man always to be a baby. There is no God, or if there is, the tradesman thinks, 'twere funny if he should take it ill in me to make a little money. Some others also, to themselves, who scarce so much as doubt it, think there is none when they are well, and do not think about it. But country folks who live beneath the shadow of the steeple, the parson and the parson's wife, and mostly married people, youths green and happy in first love, so thankful for illusion, and men caught out in what the world calls guilt in first confusion, and almost everyone, when age, disease, or sorrows strike him, inclines to think there is a God, or something very like him.
We are dealing here, Anthony Kenny, with what the American literary critic Alfred Kazin calls the religious imagination. Kazin referred to Mark Twain and called him the classic instance in American literature of the village atheist. Would you put Mr. Clough in that category?
I don't think he's ever an atheist, but I'd be happy to call him the village agnostic. I think, though, that he is an expression of the religious imagination, because, as I say, he's an agnostic who continued to value religion, and some of his most agnostic poems sound very like the poems of very religious writers talking about the dark night of the soul. As when there is a long prayer of his, it's called, by a Greek title, Hymnos a Hymnos, which means a hymn that is not a hymn. And it really is a prayer to God, saying that, of course, I don't really expect ever to have you in my mind or really feel you. As long as your work is in the work of my hands, I don't ask to feel you within.
Quick footnote to our conversation, Anthony Kenny. Why are you interested personally in this man, Clough? Is there some connection here between, for example, your life and his own that creates this interest in you?
Well, I feel that I have been through quite a lot of the intellectual, religious, emotional experience that Clough went through, and that's one reason why I feel I can appreciate his poetry, because I find in it beautifully expressed with great economy, irony, and also laughter. Experiences which can be bitter and painful, and yet worthwhile.
Anthony Kenny is the master of Balliol College at Oxford University. He's the author of books about Aristotelian logic, faith and reason, and philosophy and religion. Anthony Kenny's most recent book is The Road to Hillsborough, published in 1987 by Pergamon Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on English Literary Landscapes continues now with a discussion about English literature and its audiences in the Middle Ages. My guest is Robert Yeager of the University of North Carolina at Asheville. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Robert Yeager worked on a forthcoming study about classicism and late medieval British literature. Here is Robert Yeager.
Well, Wayne, it starts with Chaucer and Gower and runs through the people that are usually called Chaucerians. That is to say, in England, people like Hoccleve, Lydgate, a man named Usk. In Scotland, people named Dunbar and Henryson, and we'll probably finish with Douglas, who translated the Aeneid and the first translation of the Aeneid into Middle Scots, actually, but it's the closest English we had. And then we'll probably end with Skelton. We don't really know what Caxton's press runs were, for example.
Nobody was keeping count.
No, And we don't have enough things left to be able to tell. What we can tell is what things were more popular than others. We, for example, John Gower, another poet that is in my particular interest. Gower had three editions of his Confessio Montis printed between 1490 and 1530.
Mm-hmm.
By two different printers. There may have been a fourth one. There's a notice of an edition that nobody's been able to find since about 1800.
Uh-huh.
But if so, there would have been another one of those printed. And that's a pretty good indication that there were a lot of people that wanted to buy that book. I mean, the printers were very canny businessmen, and mm-hmm. they didn't print stuff.
Let's focus, Bob Yeager, on one of you mentioned John Gower, you mentioned Geoffrey Chaucer. I suppose Chaucer would be the more familiar of the two names to
sure.
popular audiences today. And we got the problem of audience, we got the problem of measuring the impact on the audience. Talk to me about this.
Sure. Well, that actually is at the center of what I'm doing, because as you know, the 15th century is often looked at as being a kind of hole between I avoid the word swamp. I'll come back to swamp. Between Chaucer and whoever you want to pick as the beginning of Renaissance poetry on the other side. I mean, Wyatt, Surrey, Spencer, Shakespeare, whomever mm-hmm. you want. And in between there, you have this group of people that I'm looking at. Now, Chaucer is in there because I think not because he's a poet whose reputation is in any trouble, certainly, but because he's someone who I think clearly gave inspiration in particular ways to all the people that I'm looking at. And it's those elements in Chaucer's work that I'm concerned to
right.
look at.
You're looking at what you call what the literary historians call the Scottish Chaucerians.
Eventually, yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
In other words, not immediately on the heels of what he did.
No. These, I mean, they're at the end, they're sort of 1480, 1475. Henryson dies in 1511, something like that. That's mm-hmm. not exactly right, but somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
So these are people who are looking back at Chaucer with, you know, 60, 70 years in between. And they're writing stuff in his steps, as they themselves say. But they're also writing a lot of things that don't have anything. Chaucer wouldn't have recognized them at all.
Did they recognize their work as derivative? Did they look at Chaucer and deliberately say, "Here is a poetic, a rhetorical model"?
Sure.
That we want to imitate.
Don't use the word imitation. That's an interesting kind of Renaissance.
What
idea.
Word would they use?
Well, they say Chaucer is their master,
mm-hmm.
and they say that Chaucer is the great poet of their immediate period.
But why not imitate?
Well, because the word imitation is apparently not something that they thought of as being what poets ought to do for another. Now the reason I stress that is because, as you know, Renaissance poetic theory puts a great deal of weight on imitation. The idea that the way you learn to be a poet is by writing in the forms,
uh-huh.
so to speak, and mastering one after the other until finally you produce something else. I mean, Milton's career is shaped like that, Spencer's
yeah.
career is shaped like that, and so on. This isn't something, if the people I'm looking at said that,
mm-hmm.
it would be easier to prove to a contemporary audience that they actually do have a certain kind of classical sense of themselves.
Well, let's pause on, again, the word audience, Bob Yeager. What kinds of assumptions, here I'm asking you to move backward in time and get inside the minds of people like Geoffrey Chaucer and John Gower, what kinds of assumptions do you extrapolate about the way they viewed audience? Again, are we looking at a small sort of elite clique,
sure.
people who've got money, who can go out and have manuscripts copied and take them home and enjoy them around the fireside? Does the word popular enter into this enterprise, this poetic enterprise for these writers at all?
Not from their point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not concerned to write a poetry which is going to move the watermen and the draymen of London to better themselves intellectually.
And yet, here you're telling me that Chaucer has this very real-world, substantial connection to that element of the population.
That's one of the reasons why we'd like to know a lot more about his biography and about the biography of all these people. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
they're fascinating little pieces that come in like this. for us, and they're the kinds. They're some of the kinds of things that I use to do what I'm doing. But the people that are listening to this stuff, reading it to themselves, reading it to each other, we have evidence in texts of people reading other texts to each other, so we know that happened a lot. Mm-hmm. They're courtiers. They're the gentry, as Chaucer was and as Gower was, who have money and who can afford to do this sort of stuff. They're to some degree the aristocracy, although the real literati of the period are not the high nobility. They have other business to take care of. I mean, they
preserving their wealth.
Yeah, and fighting wars and political, you know, and dressing nicely and things like that. And,
yeah.
You know, it's really kind of depressing. The libraries that we have accounts of usually come from wills. Wills are books were valuable, and so they were usually listed as things that could be inherited. And the problem, and there are several problems with that as evidence, but one of the problems is that the books that are listed are always the books that have the most valuable covers or are the most richly wrought and mm-hmm. so forth. And so one of the problems is that if you just happen to have a little Caxton, which was a knockout paper piece in black letter, you might not list it because it really isn't worth very much. Whereas you do list this awful leather-bound, yeah. gold-leafed thing, which nobody ever looked at, the equivalent of the 14th-century coffee table book. Nobody ever read it.
And therefore, we flip-flop the literary importance of
right.
what got saved and what got thrown away.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And it's kind of depressing if you use those things as the information to judge what people read, to mm-hmm. find out what the aristocrats were reading. I mean, mm-hmm. junk.
Bob Yeager, let me put you on the defensive a little bit, a sort of a so what question. Your topic is Gower, Chaucer, the Scottish Chaucerians. You're writing about British poetry in the 14th and 15th century. What's the big deal? I mean, you make your living professing this stuff to students and writing relatively, maybe largely esoteric kinds of articles. Does this matter at all today? Are we talking about literary pins and the numbers of angels that dance on the heads of these pins? help me with that a little bit.
Well, I suppose that's a question you can ask anybody who writes about literature at all. I mean, I guess probably Chaucer is as relevant as Joyce is as relevant as anyone.
Yeah, because, here, what you're doing is you have the temerity to talk to me about these relatively obscure poets and use the word audience at the same time.
Okay.
And here we're speaking to a general audience who people are maybe blinking and saying,
who?
Yeah, what's the big deal?
Well, I think that's why I'm doing this particular group of people. I mean, if you think about the literary history that you've had, you end up with Chaucer. The Middle Ages, it culminates in Chaucer. You have, the survey course ends with Chaucer. And then all of a sudden, you jump into the 16th century. And in between, you see, there's 110 years. And if you ask anybody about what happened in there, well, they say, well, there's a lot of boring stuff written. And so let's just move on to the good stuff. The swamp, that's right. Well, see, I use the word swamp on purpose because a swamp seems to me to be a really good metaphor for this period. And to justify my work, it seems to me that here we have 100 years during which people lived and died, loved, breathed, and wrote poetry and liked it or didn't, argued about it, said, have you read the new Lydgate poem or the new Hockleave piece? and we have people into the 16th century who praised them. I mean, we have a lot of folks who said, yeah, I read that. I mean, Shakespeare, for example.
But from our perspective, this was a time in which there was really nothing to get excited about.
That's right. And so we skip. It's the only period of English or American literature
uh-huh.
that nobody ever reads. And it goes on for a long time. And it has a number of figures that were important in their own day.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly we just sort of say, well, let's skip over that. Now, uh-huh. now to me, that's a challenge. To me, that's more valuable than writing the 3,000th book on Shakespeare.
Right.
Because if you can show people that this was a period in their history, in the life of their language, their English letters,
mm-hmm.
that had a different aesthetic than the one we're reading back into it and therefore talking about them as failures, or not talking about them at all, you've done something which really does have some significance because it recovers for the audience of Steve Sixpack or whatever a whole piece of his history that he doesn't know anything about. He doesn't, from my point of view, to be a little defensive here,
yeah.
From my point of view, he probably doesn't need another book on Shakespeare, but he does need the 15th century back.
Uh-huh. He or his kids.
He or his kids, yeah. Or she or her kids. Right. I don't mean to be sexist about
sure.
this. I mean, Susie Sixpack can read this stuff too. To go back to the swamp idea, maybe this is a metaphor that is helpful. If you think about a swamp, it's a place where from the surface we think that it's chaotic and things sink into it and never come back out. But if you know anything about swamps, you know that really there's usually some sort of watershed that comes mm-hmm. into it at one end, and there's usually some sort of exit for the water at the other. And if you think about the one
something
stream,
happens in between.
And something happens in between. And if you think about the one stream that comes in as Chaucer in the Middle Ages, and if you think about the great river that rolls out the other end as the Renaissance, you mm-hmm. have to get from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. And in the middle is this thing. Now, if you strip off the surface water from a swamp, you find that the bed of a swamp is a whole lot of little channels where that river that comes in the one side breaks itself up and experiments around to see which direction it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then it finally gathers itself at the other end and comes out. And it's all those little channels, many of which go different directions than the big river uh-huh. that I'm looking at.
I don't know if we should block the metaphor, but it seems to me that you've discovered a new discipline. Shall we call it literary ecology?
Sure, sure. That's better than swampology, which I've had some people come up with every once in a while. The other thing about it, too, is that swamps are, of course, the place where all the species of big, fancy fish breed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the big, fancy fish of the Renaissance, in many ways, had fingerling periods back in the time I'm looking at. So to me, this is a very relevant thing to do. And I think that if I do my work well, I won't have to answer that question very much anymore.
Robert Yeager teaches at the University of North Carolina at Asheville. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Robert Yeager worked on a forthcoming study entitled Classicism as an Ideal for Style in Late Medieval British Literature. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on English Literary Landscapes is available on cassette. Ask for program number 382. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The program number is 382. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be 20th century American literary culture. My guests will be John Thomas of Brown University and Townsend Ludington of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
English Literary Landscapes, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center. From what one critic calls the swamp of British medieval literature to the Victorian wasteland, some answers and insights from Anthony Kenny of Oxford University and Robert Yeager of the University of North Carolina at Asheville. English Literary Landscapes, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.